Hi there, and welcome in to this Wednesday edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. I'm back. I'm just going for a day. It was a busy day yesterday. How are you? Are you doing well? I hope you are. Good to have you along for the ride on this Wednesday edition of the Daily Perspective. A lot has happened. We'll talk about some of it. We'll poke fun at some of it. We'll make some observations, hopefully draw a little insight, enjoy some absurdity with little old me, Mark Congleton, your sometimes humble host, for this sometimes hour of almost daily. I'm having to put qualifiers in now because my schedule's changing. Oh my, this little adventure into the weirdness that is the world around us each day. Hopefully you are well. Hopefully your loved ones are doing well. And you are coping as well as possible with what's happening around us, this pandemic, this insanity that's happening. And more and more, I just can't deny the fact that it's government overreach that's inconveniencing all of us, that's causing damage to our economy, that's it's just creating all kinds of issues that should not be happening. But I hope that we will learn a lesson from all of this, and that lesson being that we cannot let government have too much power. Because if we do, then it takes advantage of us. It takes advantage of us every time. And when it takes advantage of us, it feels more powerful and it will take further advantage of us. So let's learn the lesson from this experience that right now what's happening around us is because we've let government get too strong. We've let it get too powerful. Here's an example, and it's an absurd example. San Clemente, California officials, you've no doubt seen this story. They filled a skate park with sand. They spent taxpayer dollars and trucked 37 tons of sand to a skate park to stop skateboarders from ignoring coronavirus no trespassing signs, because the kids were out there exercising in the fresh air in the park at the skate park, because, you know, being cooped up inside is just a miserable thing. And the geniuses in local government, being what they were, put up no trespassing signs and informed people, hey, because of coronavirus, you should be at home. Skateboard on your own walls. But they were ignoring the signs, doing what they want to do. That's kind of the whole mentality behind the skaters. You've just got to admit that. Well, you know what happened? I don't know if you know, as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story. Do you know? Well, the skaters came back with shovels and with BMX bikes. They decided to make the best of a stupid situation and do a little BMXing in the skate park with all the sand all over it. So that was their answer to the situation. Oh my gosh. I love a little absurdity and the way it all plays out from time to time. Speaking of absurd, Jimmy Kimmel, did you see what he's done in the last day or so? He went off on the states opening for business. The states that are reopening for business, the businesses that are reopening, the people who want to get out and go back to work, he's going nuts on them. Essentially telling them they want everybody to die. And then he asks this question. Who's going to work all those jobs in agriculture? Well, he's talking about the shutdown of the border as well. He's talking about all this stuff, opening for business and shutting down the borders. We shut down the borders and don't let people come into the country. He asks, who's going to work all those jobs in agriculture? You know, picking all those veggies and stuff. Who's going to do that? Who's going to work in your restaurant kitchens? Who's going to be doing all of these things? Oh, I don't know, Jimmy. How about the 22 million people who've lost their jobs due to government overreach? How about these 22 million Americans, citizens of the United States, who are going to need a job? Yeah, I realize it may not be what they were doing before, especially if their business isn't opening back up again, but an income is an income, until things shift and you can get back where you need to be. How about that, Jimmy? Of course, with as much money as you have, sir, that doesn't occur to you, does it? And all of your little toadies who work with you and for you, who are living well, who have all the money they need, who haven't lost their jobs. You see, Jimmy Kimmel is a member of the progressive elite. He thinks everyone who doesn't think like him is an idiot. And we see that on a regular basis all over the place. We see these people like Jimmy Kimmel, like Joy, oh my God, Behar. If we can go back and even deeper into the cesspool of absurdity that is television and the entertainment industry, Joy Behar. I'm not going to get into exactly what she has said, but let's just suffice it to say that if Joy Behar is opening her pie hole, nothing but stupidity is coming out of it. She's angry. She is deeply hateful of our president. And she looks down her rather wealthy nose at anyone who disagrees with her and thinks they're stupid. Another progressive mentality trait. These are the people I keep telling you about. The ones who believe wholeheartedly that they are intellectually and morally superior to you because you don't see life the same way they do. Does that mean you're stupid? No. It means they aren't connected to reality. The more you see what these people believe, and the more you see them trying to argue their points, the more you realize they really don't know what they're talking about. I challenge you today to go look up some videos, the Change My Mind videos. Oh, you know who I'm talking about. Hang on a second. Let me pull one of them up so I can tell you more about this. Wrong screen. How many browsers do I have open? there's just so many browsers. There's so many windows open. Oh. Let's see here. Steven Crowder, Change My Mind. Let's see here. If you can look at practically any of them. And what Steven Crowder does is that he will go, let's say, onto a college campus, and he will set up a table. A little, just a little table with a couple of chairs behind it. He has two microphones. He has some guys with cameras standing by. He also has security because he has learned he has to have security because when he's dealing with people on college campuses or outside of government buildings and things like that, that certain people are going to be there who are cray-cray. Well, the most recent one was, I'm pro-gun. I'm pro-gun. Change my mind. And the thing is that people will sit down with him and disagree with him, but not have any basis for their disagreement. They will make their arguments based on what they have heard or what they have seen on social media. Or what they have been told is the truth, rather than what is the truth. And that goes for practically any subject. This Change My Mind videos are a real eye-opener. And you really should go watch a few of them. And it doesn't matter what the topic is. Because when Steven Crowder is out there in public and he's talking to people, he is calm, he is cool, he's collected, he is respectful, he is polite. And he just states the facts. And he doesn't just pull them from his hip pocket or from somewhere in the back recesses of his brain. He has a binder on the table, which he at some point will open. And he has all these pages in this binder with the actual quotes, articles, and references. With the laws, with the documents. He's got it all right there with him. And he is making his argument based on reality. It's all in that binder. And the people who argue with him, one of the most recent ones ones that I saw. I think it was, there was one about rape culture on college campuses. It's not a new one, but I saw it recently, and the person that was talking with him was having an emotional come apart, trying to get college security to trying to get the security force to take him away, trying to get him away from their place there, to have him gone so that they wouldn't have to deal with his perspective. And there was another, I don't remember what that topic was, but there was a woman who came and sat down with him who, I think it was about Trump and racism. And he kept trying to get her to see that just because people say he's a racist doesn't mean he's a racist. And she would not listen to reason. He would open the book and try to quote things and show her this is the reality of the situation. And she would just cross her arms and say, oh, it's easy for you to do this. Blah, 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 blah. And she would just argue him down with nothing. She would actually, she would become condescending. It was really interesting to watch. But that's the mentality you deal with from the progressive left. It's not a matter of facts. They talk about facts and science and experts. But the problem with that is that their experts are generally just spitballing, throwing things against the wall to see if they'll stick. They're making assertions based on computer models. And oftentimes those computer models are built on data which is just a guess. Sometimes it's built on prior computer models, such as in climate change, man-made climate change. All of those claims that people like Al Gore have made about cities being underwater on the coast and the like, which is really interesting from a guy who has a really, really expensive coastal home, kind of like the Obamas. This is the mentality. And every time I see it, it wigs me out. It drives me nuts because they don't listen. They won't listen. Their mind is made up, and as far as they're concerned, if you don't agree with them, you're an idiot. There's no room for any kind of possibility that they could be wrong about anything. And when you see someone like Steven Crowder sit down calmly, cool, collected, without a problem in the world with what he's talking about because he has the facts. He's got his little binder with the facts in it. And he's polite. He doesn't call anybody names. He just asks them, well, what about this? What about that? Well, and they'll make assertions, and he'll say, well, actually, that's not true because of this. And he'll quote them something, and then they'll say, well, that's not true, and then he'll reach for his binder. You should watch the videos. It's good stuff. It's very revealing about the way people think and why they think what they think. And it'll help you understand even better why the progressive left is so apoplectic about the way things are going right now. We need to remember, as this all of this is going on around us with people like Jimmy Kimmel and people like Joy Behar and the like, that there were reasons for doing what we're doing. The initial reason for social distancing, business closures, and such wasn't to keep everyone from being infected. It was to keep our medical system from being overwhelmed. These measures were to slow the rate of infection, because people with brains understood everybody's going to get exposed at some point. But if we slow that exposure down, we can manage it medically. That was the reason. Well, we're seeing that actually play out. We're seeing it work. And it's time for a measured reopening of things. More people are going to become infected. We are going to see some more deaths. Deaths which, by the way, were going to happen either way. Because when you look at the facts, you understand, by and large, the people who have been affected terminally by the coronavirus also had comorbidities, other things which were going to kill them. And we're also finding out that a lot of the deaths have been attributed to coronavirus, which weren't actually coronavirus. And that's fishy. The purpose, as I said, was to slow things down. Now, as we begin to reopen things, you're going to see some people get sick. You're going to see some more infections. You're going to see the progressive screech, "I told you so, I told you so." And they're totally missing the point. Well, that was interesting. Welcome back to the Daily Perspective Podcast. Hi there, Mark Congleton here with you, hoping you're having a good day. The reason I said that was interesting is that if you're on the live feed, you caught it. If you're listening to the podcast, you didn't catch it, because on the podcast version, the one that I post for replay later on, I always cut the breaks out. Well, the computer did it for me just then. No break. Interesting. So that means that today's podcast is going to be, for me, a bit shorter than normal, because the breaks are not going to be in the mix. So let me set those to one side there. It is a Wednesday edition of the podcast. And now my brain is spinning. Why? Why did it do? Why? Because never mind. Anyway, I want to get into a story here that I saw a couple of days ago. It was posted on Sunday on Newsmax.com, and it's an article. It's an op-ed piece by Craig Shirley, and it's called "Pandemic Mandates Federalism's Return," and it goes hand in hand with what I was saying the other day about needing to remember that we are a nation of states, sovereign states. They govern themselves. And the federal government in Washington, D.C. is there as the backup and serves key and specific purposes in the role of the sovereign states. Now, I'm not going to get all wonky as far as constitutionalism is concerned. This is not going to be an in-premise lecture or anything like that. This is I'm not going to get into that. I'm not qualified for that. I just want to pass along to you a perspective that I think is accurate. And here we go with Craig Shirley's article from Newsmax. And I may jump in from time to time with my own little take on things. Here we go. For the first time this century, the national media has suddenly remembered that governors and the various states exist, but apparently only those with whom they agree. The mainstay argument from the rest of the national media has been, we need a national solution to a national problem. Really? None have explained how amassing masks and ventilators and gloves at the national level is better than the 50 states acquiring their own inventories for more efficient and quicker dispersal to the citizenry. Nor have they explained exactly what a national solution is. So it appears to be nothing more than another club with which to beat Donald Trump. Is it really practical or desirable to line up 340 million people single file to get tested for the coronavirus? Or is it just about the national party and the national media acquiring more power in the nation's capital? With centralization, we have one chance to get it right. With federalism, we have 50 chances to get it right. Ohio and California have done well minimizing the threat. New York, not so good. Michigan is a disaster. And Kentucky must have elected Pontius Pilate, the way he went after Christians on Easter Sunday. But that is the point. Heaven help us if the anti-freedom governors of Michigan or Kentucky ever get close to national power. Their mindless crackdown on personal freedom illustrates precisely why it is so dangerous to give power to liberals. This is explained why liberals in the past have smeared the notion of states' rights as racist. They know they lose any debate about the 10th Amendment. What is most disheartening is that in the party of federalism, the Republican Party, there are so few who can really articulate the practicality, the intellectualism, or the superiority of federalism. The Democrats have put their trust in Washington since the New Deal. They understand that what they are about, the acquisition of power. The GOP, on the other hand, appears so confused, they don't know whether to scratch their watch or wind their behind. In the days of Reagan, everybody in the GOP could explain federalism. Now the GOP has two approaches: attack, 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 or ignorance. This should be a glorious time to put federalism into practice and thus save lives. In fact, federalism in theory and in practice is the best answer to getting America past this coronavirus crisis. Practically, one can argue that 50 solutions to a problem are better than one. Yet for most of the past 70 years, the emphasis has always been on the primacy of centralized government, despite the fact that no one likes or trusts the federal government. A recent Rasmussen poll showed an astonishing number, 65% of Americans, believe the FBI routinely breaks the law and illegally spies on private citizens. With good reason, Americans have not trusted Washington since the 1950s. More to the point, the very essence of our republic is based in opposition to granting too much power to the national seat of power. Even James Madison, the father of the U.S. Constitution, which replaced the state-centric Articles of the Confederation, said, quote, "The powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined. Those which are to remain in the state governments are numerous and indefinite." Madison went even further, saying it was never the intention to let Washington determine all laws and all power. The famous draft boards of World War II were the perfect expression of federalism at its working best. Millions of men were needed quickly for the fight against the Nazis and Japan. The War Department could not amass the 3 to 6 million young men needed immediately. Thousands of draft boards at the local level made up responsible local citizens reviewed the eligibility of young men whom they deemed 1A. And all this happened under the liberal, but also practical, president, Franklin D. Roosevelt. Modern sophisticates have believed for years that the federal government reigns supreme and the states are loyal subjects. But if this crisis has proven anything, it is that no central planning can mobilize and institute change more effectively than our sovereign states. Each state knows their problems and limitations more acutely, and each state is better equipped to deal with them, and deal with them expeditiously. Not long ago, the New York Times ran an article showing the average travel distance of individuals has fallen below 2 miles from home since news of the virus. The South was disproportionately traveling, while places like New York were at a standstill. Several smug elites, most notably the New York Times' Michael Barbaro, took the opportunity to publicly mock southern states, implying their actions were a result of scientific illiteracy or some other deficiency. In reality, the majority of these trips were due to the fact that southerners in rural areas have to travel greater distances for essential supplies. Frankly, decentralized states will have a far easier time mitigating the spread of the disease than centralized cities like New York, where locals are packed into apartments like sardines. Still, they have every right to their lifestyle, as does the South. The simple fact, there is no one-size-fits-all solution. What works for California may not work for the Carolinas. Ergo, a national solution is worse than ineffectual. It's silly. It's anti-intellectual. The president, specifically his son-in-law, has struggled to articulate where exactly the federal responsibility ends and the state responsibility begins. The truth is, the more we've come to rely on federal government, the more we've marginalized our state governments. The confusion we see today is a direct result of that. When the dust settles and the crisis has passed, there is going to be a serious conversation about what went wrong and how it can be fixed. The smartest solution is a return to federalism. The federal government was never intended to run all 50 states. It was intended to represent them. Its role should be one of advisor and supporter. Instead of hoarding ventilators and protective equipment in some large federal reserve, it should mandate or recommend to the states how most effectively to keep their own strategic reserve. It's one thing for the government to say, every state should have one ventilator per however many people. It's quite another for the government to hoard them all and only relinquish them when D.C. feels it's appropriate. Does anybody really believe that one corrupt city by the Potomac River can solve any of our problems? President Trump is stumbling toward the truth, but he is right. Let the states go first. As the great Milton Friedman once said, if you put the federal government in charge of the Sahara Desert, in 5 years, there'd be a shortage of sand. And Craig Shirley is right on the money. He's absolutely right. Life is different everywhere in the United States. What we face each day is different. What we need each day is different. What we do each day is different. The article talks about people crammed into apartments in New York like sardines. The same for the subway system. But did you know that the intellectual, progressive geniuses in charge in New York City reduced the number of subway cars? I'll wait for that shoe to drop. Yeah, that's right. Fewer subway cars means people jammed tighter together, which means social distancing becomes impossible. No such thing as 6 feet of distance between you and the next person. Not when they've restricted the amount of cars you can get on. And even if they are distancing in the cars, they're still piling up on the platforms waiting for the next train to come by because that one didn't have enough cars in it. When it comes to intelligent solutions, you can usually count on the progressives to get it backwards. Or the solutions will favor the power of the government rather than the ingenuity and the resourcefulness of the people and independent businesses. This is something we need to remember going forward. There have been mistakes made. There have been things done very, very wrong. And there's been a lot of trust placed in places where trust should never be placed. And that is in the hands of politicians. Because the politicians don't live where you live anymore. One prime example is that Congresswoman who has two $24,000 refrigerators and tons of designer ice cream in her multi-million dollar mansion in San Francisco, where constituents there are homeless and living on the street. And she's talking about how chocolate is her favorite thing when she's on late night TV. Nancy Pelosi is severely disconnected, as are many in Washington, D.C. You are listening to the Daily Perspective Podcast. Hi there, Mark Dongleton here with you, hoping you are having a fantastic Wednesday. It's a brakeless Wednesday. The brakes are out on the big bus. We're just barreling forward. It's funny. You get used to the way things work. And because of the little goof up that's happening with the computer today, and it's completely my fault. I was working on something and completely ignored something that I needed to do. Because from time to time with computers, you do need to click on things to make things happen. And at one point, I didn't at the right time, and things got messed up. Anyway, so no spots in the breaks. It's just going from bumper music to bumper music. So I reach over when the bumper music ended, that last segment ended, and I picked up my little snack, and I was going to unwrap it, and then boom! The next bumper music started. Oh, there won't be a snack for me today. It's a midweek edition of the podcast. Things are back to Abby normal. And I hope you're doing well. I hope things are good with you. I hope you and yours are doing well. And I hope you're going to have a great Wednesday. And that somehow you're maintaining your sanity, whether it's through your regular routine because your job is deemed essential. My wife's job, by the way, is deemed essential. She goes into work every day, gets up and goes into work every day. And she's a cashier at a car dealership in the parts and service department. So in that area, if you get your car fixed or you need a part for your car, the particular kinds of cars that they sell there, you go in there and you pay her. And she sits behind the glass and talks to people every day. And she's got her little mask that she wears when she's got to deal with somebody, you know, so she goes into work every day because car service places have been deemed essential. And that kind of makes sense if you think about it. So there are a lot of people who are still going back into work, even though 22 million Americans, because the government has taken an absurd step in doing what they've done, in my opinion. They've gone a bit too far. You see, we probably could have mitigated this just by recognizing who was the most susceptible and mandating that those people not socialize, that those people step back and prevent themselves from getting sick and then deal with the rest as it came, which is basically what's happened in Sweden. And it's working in Sweden. Everybody said, oh, that'll never work. There was a lot of gasping and clutching of pearls and, oh, that's terrible. They just want everybody to die. Yeah, that's what they want. That's what every government wants. They want their people to die. Yeah, we'll go with that idea. Hey, what a maroon. Anyway, all I can say is...
ain't nobody got time for that.
I sure don't. In an interview with CNN Monday evening, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi tried to flip the script on the Paycheck Protection Program. And that is, after it became clear the program to help small businesses during the coronavirus crisis would run out of money quickly, Pelosi and her fellow Democrats stalled. This is something you already know, right? Well, on CNN Monday, she suggested, it was the Republicans' fault. Because, of course, it was. She told Anderson Cooper, when the Secretary, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, came and asked me for $250 billion, a quarter of a trillion dollars in 24 hours, I said, well, we want to see the data on how that is spent, but we also want to make sure, as long as we are going to the floor, that we do so in a way that makes sure that everyone can participate in the program. They said no, 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 until about 100 hours ago. They said no, and now they're saying yes. It was totally those dastardly Republicans who extended the House of Representatives vacation. It was totally those dastardly Republicans who blocked the legislation to add $250 billion to the Paycheck Protection Program, right? Nancy's struggling with a bad case of projection. See, while she was enjoying her fancy designer ice cream in her fancy mansion, out of her fancy refrigerators, millions of Americans were losing their livelihoods. She's still getting a paycheck. So why did Democrats delay? Well, Representative Pramila Jayapal, the Democrat from Washington, explained it rather succinctly in a virtual press conference. She said, I think what you're hearing from all of us on this call is that we have real concerns about giving away leverage now without getting some of the priorities that we need. What are the priorities that Democrats need? Why, structural reforms to American law, of course. After all, last month, Democrats stalled the $2 trillion stimulus bill and presented their own alternative version, which was jam-packed with pet projects like Green New Deal-style energy regulations on airlines, collective bargaining for unions, the 15-hour minimum wage, and 60 pages just on elections. This desire to use the coronavirus crisis to jam Democratic priorities down Americans' throats goes all the way to the top of the Democratic Party. Presumptive nominee Joe Biden has called the crisis an opportunity for structural change on climate and voting. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez showed a similar spirit. when she celebrated the negative prices for oil, which threatened millions of oil and gas workers, because the crisis seemed to be an opportunity for her to push her Green New Deal. What does it matter if millions of Americans are suffering amid an economic crisis, so long as Democrats can find some leverage to push their radical agenda, right? Well, the House adjourned without voting on expanding funds for the Paycheck Protection Program. Representative Brian Mast, a Republican from Florida, claimed that Pelosi's Democrats adjourned the House of Representatives as fast as possible. He says, so that I wouldn't have an opportunity to highlight the absolutely failed leadership that is occurring right now. Meanwhile, outlets like the Washington Post are shamelessly carrying water for the Democrats, suggesting that fast food franchises are not small businesses and suggesting that Republicans are to blame for the delay. Just in case you're wondering, just because it says Wendy's or Burger King or McDonald's on the sign outside, it doesn't mean that the company owns and operates that particular fast food restaurant. No. There are local businessmen who buy franchises. They buy the rights to use the name. They follow the company's guidelines. But they're owned and operated by small business people. And they employ people in entry-level positions, taking orders at the counter, in the window, working in the kitchen, things like that. Those are all entry-level job positions. Not supposed to be careers for supporting families. Let's be clear about that. But it's all independent businessmen, small businesses, for the most part. There are some company-owned restaurants. Yes, there are. But by and large, not so. But back to the general gist of this, and that is that the Democrats are responsible for people not being able to get paid right now. The Democrats are responsible for the holdup in the cash flow, because the Democrats want to be able to send millions upon millions to places like Planned Parenthood. For medical care, Planned Parenthood actually doesn't provide. They want to send millions of dollars to their pets in certain places like the Kennedy Center, which then let go their employees after they got their grant. They want to send millions upon millions of dollars to those who are faithful to them, because they know they're buying votes, they're buying support, they're greasing the wheels of the acquisition of power. And that's what they're doing. Well, let's be clear. The Democrats don't care about you. They care about power and control. They care about power and control because they firmly believe that they are intellectually and morally superior, and that without them, you will founder and flounder and not be able to make your way through life. This is what they believe. They believe that everything should be pulled into that one centralized government in Washington, D.C. that we talked about previously, that can't get anything right, that if put in charge of the Sahara Desert, would end up with a sand shortage in about 5 years, as Milton Friedman said. That's where they think this all needs to be. And when we look at their track record, it's obvious. It's the last place, we should put this kind of power. Federalism is the answer. The states are the answer. The 10th Amendment is the answer. Your state should be calling the shots and then falling back on Washington, D.C., when, after having done all within their power to do, they still need help. Because it is not the federal government's job to handle these things. It's the state's government's job. But people like Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer believe it's the federal government's job, and that the nation is a nation state, not a nation comprised of sovereign states. When you have a nation state, when you have a federal government, a centralized government, which is too powerful, bizarre things happen. Here's an example from Australia. An Australian couple was fined for non-essential travel. You see, they posted vacation pics online to social media. And the Victoria Police Department came knocking on their door and presented them with a fine for unapproved travel. The hitch is that the vacation pictures were from their vacation from the previous year. Yeah. And the Victoria Police Department has rescinded the fine. They won't be able to post any more pictures from their vacation on their account because faceless officialdom doesn't have that much shame left. According to the UK Independent, Jazz and Gary Mott had some time on their hands, as most of us do due to the coronavirus lockdown. So they decided they'd go through the photos they took during their vacation in 2019 to the coastal town of Lakes Entrance, about 2 hours away from where they live in Traralgon, Traralgon, Victoria. Wow. Apparently somebody was paying attention. They didn't like it. The pictures were posted on April 5th. 4 days later, April 9th, an officer with the Victoria Police Department came knocking on their door. Jazz Mott said the officer just handed me the fine and walked off, which didn't leave a whole lot of time to explain that the couple was being fined for infringement of the lockdown order there banning non-essential travel. The fine was for $1,652, about $1,041 U.S. The obvious reason for the fine is that the police thought the photos were posted on the same day they were taken. The question is how they actually found out about this. We'll get to that. The ticket said the Motts were in violation of failure to comply with a direction given to a person in the exercise of a power under an authorization given under Section 199. Okay. It went on to note that they were going for a drive to Lakes Entrance, non-essential travel. Well, no one had observed them driving there, of course, and the only way they'd be able to tell is by looking at the photographs of Jazz and Gary Mott in a car. Nothing in the pictures could have led anyone to determine when or where the pictures were taken. These salient pieces of information tying them to a violation of the law in the time of coronavirus weren't an impediment to the police, though. So, yes, after the couple contacted local media, the fine was canceled. Sanity prevailed, right? Not quite. Jazz told the Independent, "The sergeant told me if I posted any more photos, I'll be arrested." The Victoria Police Department issued the pro forma mistakes were made statement. A department representative said, "This incident has been reviewed and the decision has been made to withdraw the infringement notice. On occasion, errors will be made. However, that is why a review process exists, to ensure instances such as these are identified and rectified. Police are not specifically monitoring social media accounts to identify breaches of the chief health officer directives. In general, police will follow up and investigate the circumstances surrounding individual potential breaches reported by the public." This would have had to have been reported by the public. A screenshot of the photos posted to Facebook seems to indicate it was set to friends only status. That means the cops wouldn't have just been trawling the accounts of public places looking for people foolish enough to tag themselves in photographs visiting there. On the other hand, was there any questioning? Could they have done some follow-up work with the Motts before they wrote a pretty hefty chit for them and wordlessly handed it over at their residence? Did they not see the ways this could backfire? It wasn't an honest mistake. This was just tyranny in practice. And this is what happens when government is given too much power. For example, we've talked about New York. New York City telling people, "Hey, send us cell phone photos of people breaking the orders here. You know, they're not social distancing. Let us know." Well, that backfired in a huge way. We'll talk about that in just a moment as the Daily Perspective continues. Back to to the Daily Perspective Podcast. My, oh my, oh my. It's the midweek Wednesday edition of the podcast. And we're looking at all things idiotic with government and the coronavirus. And there's a story that I want to get to next about how the coronavirus numbers are being skewed. I trust me, it's not all that technical. It's a little technical, but it's not all that technical. But first, we'll get back to Bill de Blasio, the commie in New York City, and his idiotic proposal that people snitch on those who are not social distancing and practicing the proper procedures, staying at home. They're not locking themselves up at home, in other words. Well, they set up a place to send the photos, and they got photos. Boy, did they get photos. Lots of them. They got primarily penis pictures and Hitler memes. That's what they got. So people sent them vile pictures and Hitler memes. I think the people have spoken, don't you? Oh, sure, Mayor de Blasio. This is what we think about what you have decided for us to do. And it is so typical of progressive government. They believe they're the smartest people in the room. And progressives in general, they believe they're the smartest people in the room. But the fact is they're disconnected from reality to the degree that they propose bizarre things. This is what we need to do. The experts say. Right. Yeah, you go with that. I'm fine over here. Thank you. Have a nice day. No, really, have a nice day, but have it somewhere else. Well, now let's go to this next story. Matt Margolis, he writes for PJ Media. He writes a story called, Here's How Much Downstate New York is Skewing the U.S. Coronavirus Numbers. Here's what he has to say. I live in New York State, but I live in Western New York, not New York City or Downstate. If you ask anyone from Downstate, they are New Yorkers. I'm not. I am quite honestly okay with that. I have no problem with not being lumped in with the Downstaters. Except I still am. New York is a hotspot when it comes to the coronavirus cases and deaths, but that's only because of Downstate. Upstate New York's coronavirus situation pales in comparison to Downstate. New York City, in particular, was doomed due to the incompetence of local leaders, as well as other factors, such as population density and its subway system aiding in the spread of the virus. Personally, I've thought for weeks we should be counting Downstate New York separately from the rest of the country. So, I looked at the numbers to see what happens when you separate Downstate New York from the rest of the country. The numbers are shocking. Downstate has been so heavily impacted by the coronavirus that it skews the United States when you compare us to the rest of the world. Downstate New York technically includes New York City, Long Island, and the Hudson Valley. But I'm only including Kings, Queens, New York, Suffolk, Bronx, Nassau, Westchester, and Richmond counties. These counties have a population of 12,205,796, according to World Population Review's numbers for 2020. Bigger than many countries. After compiling data for the top 30 countries with the most cases of the coronavirus, I ranked the top 10 countries by confirmed cases per capita. That's per million. Based on the Center for Systems Science and Engineering at Johns Hopkins University's data, as of 11 a.m. Eastern on April 18th. Number one was Spain. Number two, Belgium. Number three, Switzerland. Number four, Italy. Number five, Ireland. Number six, France. Number seven, United States. Number eight, Portugal. Number nine, the Netherlands. And number 10, the United Kingdom. Right away, we can see that the United States does not lead the world in coronavirus cases. Even with Downstate New York in the mix, the United States isn't nearly as bad as the mainstream media makes it out to be. But here's what happens to the top 10 once you treat Downstate New York as its own country. Number one, Downstate New York, 16,230.65 cases. Spain is number two with 4,100. Belgium is number three with 3,200. And or we're 32 million. 3,200. Switzerland, Italy, Ireland, France, Portugal, the Netherlands, United Kingdom. Separating downstate New York from the rest of the United States shows us just how bad the situation there is. In fact, the rest of the country doesn't even rank in the top 10 anymore. It comes in at number 13. But as I've mentioned before, confirmed cases are not the best way to compare countries because of the discrepancies in testing between them. So let's compare these countries by the fatality rate per capita, per million. Now, this is based on fatalities per million. Number one is Belgium. Number two is Spain. Number three is Italy. Number four is France. Number five is the United Kingdom. Number six, the Netherlands. Number seven, Switzerland. Number eight, the United States. Number nine, Ireland. And number 10, Portugal. Once again, even with downstate New York included, the coronavirus has impacted the United States much less than other hard-hit countries. But now here's what happens when we treat downstate New York as a separate country from the United States in terms of deaths per capita. Per million, number one, downstate New York with 848.45 per million. Number two is Belgium. Number three is Spain. Number four is Italy. Number five is France. By the way, number two, back up to number two, Belgium. Remember, downstate New York, 848.45 per million. Number two is just a bit more than half that with 470.51 per million. Think about that. So Belgium was number two, Spain's three, Italy's four, five is France, six is United Kingdom, seven is the Netherlands, eight is Switzerland, nine is Sweden, and number 10 is Ireland. Once again, downstate New York leads the pack. And the United States, without downstate New York, doesn't even come in the top 10. It does come in at number 11, but it's not in the top 10. I should mention here that several countries are reportedly undercounting their cases and deaths, including Iran, China, and Russia. It's very possible that the actual case and death numbers for these countries, much higher, possibly even putting them in the top 10. But without reliable data, we can't correct for this. What we can see from the data is just how much downstate New York is skewing the data for the United States. What this tells us is that there shouldn't be a one-size-fits-all approach to social distancing or reopening the country. I feel pretty safe where I live, but because I'm in New York State and Governor Cuomo is treating the whole state like it's downstate, I have to abide by the same statewide restrictions. Further, if the media ever chose to look at the country's numbers the way I have, they'd see that the overwhelming majority of the country is doing much, much better than it appears when you include downstate New York in our numbers. The media wants you to believe that President Trump botched the federal government's response to the coronavirus. This is clearly not true. Even with downstate's tallies, we don't lead the world in cases or deaths per capita. Treating downstate as its own country shows just how much local leadership impacts containment and mitigation. So here we have local leadership in downstate New York. That's New York City, Bill de Blasio, and his directives, and the way that people live there. Everybody tight together, everything crammed up, sardines in a can on subways and things like that. This is what's contributing to the numbers of downstate New York. And if you pull that out as its own country, just that one area, it leads the world. So really, we should be looking at what they're doing wrong and making sure nobody else does what New York is doing. And the question we should ask ourselves, as far as the media coverage of this is concerned, is, let's just say if it was Wyoming. Out there in Big Sky country, that's not Wyoming, I know, but out there where it's miles and miles between people. If the death rate in Wyoming was the highest in the country, millions of people, the infection rate was bizarre, crazy. If it were swapped, if the numbers from New York were happening in Wyoming, would the press care? Would the politicians care? I'll just go ahead and say it. No. No, they wouldn't. Because what happens in flyover country isn't news. Unless it's somebody with a gun shooting something up. It wouldn't be news until it crossed a state line and somebody from Wyoming infected somebody from New York. It just wouldn't be news. It might be a blip on the radar. Oh yeah, people are sick in Wyoming, trying to figure that out. But as soon as a handful of people in New York or LA got sick, people in Los Angeles coming down with a strange virus, we don't know what it is, it would start getting attention. And that's something we need to remember, is that the press is motivated by the dense population centers where the liberals live, where the progressives live, which comprises a very small part of our country. Very small. Incidentally, it also comprises part of the country that's not really producing much of anything at all, but consuming a lot. So, they care about these population centers that aren't producing anything, but they're consuming a lot. But they don't really care about the places that are producing. And when I say producing, I mean things like crops, food, vegetables, cattle, the things that are consumed. In some cases, automobiles and other things that we buy. But they care about the places where the progressives live. And they also believe that those places are more enlightened, more in touch, and care more. And that's what's important about them. Once again, that's progressivism. They believe they are intellectually and morally superior. And everybody in flyover country is a rube and doesn't really understand the way things work. Well, I'll guarantee you, that guy who gets up at 4 a.m. and doesn't get into bed until midnight because he's had to himself repair his tractor or deliver calves in the middle of the night or to care for sick farm animals or to figure out why his crops are dying, those people who have the burden of feeding the country on their hands, who actually use computers and use the internet and use sophisticated equipment to do their jobs every day to feed America, those guys have got more on the ball than the progressives, the elites, in the elitist progressive strongholds on the coasts. Those guys know what life is really all about because they're plugged into it every day, not just observing it from a distance over their cappuccinos. So please remember, they're not looking out for your interests because they don't believe your interests matter. And we have a president who actually is looking out for your interests because he comes from a world where he really does employ people, has employed people, dealt with real people who have real families and real jobs. And he's had to meet payrolls and he's had to succeed or fail. Yeah, he's had a handful of bankruptcies, a few failures, but out of 200-plus businesses, a handful is not all that bad. That's a good success rate. And he's applying that wisdom to his job as president today. And all of those people who live by theory hate him for it. Time to go. God bless you. Have a good day. We'll see you back here tomorrow for the Thursday edition of the podcast. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Oh, we're done.